would hand over the camera to the tech, who would develop and print the film, and then return the camera, loaded with fresh film and in a concealment, to the case officer. The TOO in Moscow could also fabricate small concealments for dead drops out of fabric, leather, pieces of wood, pipes, dirty work mittens, plastic tubing, or discarded cardboard milk or juice cartons. What the TOO could not do on site with his supply of hand tools and ingenuity, he accomplished by playing the role of consultant, relaying requirements for covert devices, such as audio transmitters, to a larger OTS tech base outside the Iron Curtain or to headquarters. A TOO working in a denied area experienced the same pressures as case officers, including drawing surveillance when they shopped in the local market or drove their children to the international school. The KGB may not have realized the degree to which the Americans were monitoring and exploiting the radio transmissions of its surveillance at the time of Peterson's arrest. Certainly, they had been confounded by the small receiver, no larger than two packs of cigarettes, she carried. Development of the SRR-100 began in the early 1970s, after a communications tech intercepted transmissions on known KGB frequencies and correlated those with the movement of American personnel. Just as TSD had probed Soviet bloc mail in the 1960s to understand postal censorship patterns, the CIA now began orchestrating a series of rabbit runs to probe KGB surveillance transmissions. A set of scanners identified signals and recorded the transmissions while a dilapidated plotter charted frequencies. Receiver packages, small enough to be carried under a coat, included a time marker capability so the rabbit would push the button when he left the office, then 5 minutes later, as he took a street to the left, push the button again. Analysis of the marked times and locations were correlated with KGB radio transmissions to determine when the rabbit had surveillance and what frequency was used. Over time, a picture emerged of the type and intensity of surveillance Americans faced and how the KGB coordinated its efforts. Patterns surfaced that defined a standard operating procedure by the KGB, and detailed analysis identified types of behavior that would likely draw surveillance and which Americans were most closely watched. Recordings showed that some KGB conversations were in shorthand combinations of terms and numbers. For instance, the term 21 meant, "I have the target in sight," while some code words described specific people or activities. Brief conversations, or even single words, would indicate surveillance, while extended silence became a reliable sign they were free of their KGB watchers. The CIA discovered that their KGB watchers would follow an individual with several different teams. One set would conduct overt surveillance, while the second team would hang back, invisible. Sometimes the surveillance would walk, changing articles of clothing to avoid recognition. At other times, they would rotate colors and models of cars. Surveillance could be in fixed positions located in apartment buildings and offices. Warming rooms were provided during winter months where inactive surveillance were put on standby should their services be needed. For the operations officer, this meant that surveillance could appear and disappear at almost any time. To know with certainty when one was free of surveillance, even momentarily, was the key to conducting a clandestine act. To take advantage of these transmissions, OTS was tasked to build a concealable, body-worn monitor, conceptualized by an engineer in the Office of Communications and produced by OTS. The SRR-100 enabled the wearer to eavesdrop on KGB surveillance transmissions. The first models of the SRR-100 could pick up only a single frequency. To alter frequencies, the TOO had to change out the two-pronged crystal. Though once the monitor's effectiveness was demonstrated, OTS developed a multi-channel receiver to keep pace with the KGB's communication systems. The second half of building an operational receiver for clandestine use was designing the scanner to be covert as well as functional. The scanner had to be small enough not to attract attention on the street when worn under either summer or winter clothing. While transistors could solve this problem by powering a 3/4-inch thick receiver that was no larger than a pocket radio, the question remained of how the case officer could covertly hear the transmissions. 30 years after the SRR-100's introduction, it is now commonplace to see the young and elderly walking with headphones and earpieces coupled to devices such as iPods and cell phones. However, in Moscow, in 1973, an earbud or headphones, particularly worn by an American, would surely have attracted attention and suspicion. A telltale trace of wiring, no matter how cleverly disguised, trailing from the ear to the shirt pocket of a foreigner on the streets of Moscow, would be noticed and reported by the KGB watcher teams. The solution the techs eventually arrived at was an ingenious use of existing technology, known as an induction loop. Based on an electrical phenomenon whose applications may be traced to the mid-19th century, the induction loop operates on the principle that electrical currents sent through a wire, loop, generate an electromagnetic field that can be picked up by another nearby wire. Electromagnetic induction is similar to the way vibrations in one prong of a tuning fork cause the other prong to vibrate as well. Engineers created an induction loop that could be worn around the neck under clothing. The loop in turn was connected to a monitoring receiver worn in a shoulder harness under the armpit. For women, the device could also be placed in a special purse with the shoulder strap containing the induction loop. The loops performed double duty, acting as both an antenna receiving surveillance intercepts and a transmitter that sent intercepts to the receiver. The receiver included another, much smaller loop mounted in an earpiece resembling a hearing aid. Barely larger than the head of a cotton swab, the commercial device was manufactured by the Swiss hearing aid company, Phonak. Although the earpiece was small, it was not small enough to be worn on the street without the possibility of attracting attention. "The earpiece had an obvious problem," said one OTS staffer who was involved with the design. "You couldn't be seen wearing a piece of plastic in your ear without drawing attention." So OTS disguise specialists produced a Hollywood solution. After taking a casting of a case officer's ear, they fashioned a false silicone ear that fit over the Phonak receiver. Realistic down to the last detail, the covering was sculpted and tinted to duplicate the shadow of the ear canal. Each case officer received 4 earpieces, 2 for the right ear and 2 for the left ear. Officers could insert the receiver into the ear canal and place the ear mold in front to cover the device. In addition to masking the earpiece, the sham ear exterior offered another benefit. The sculpting was done with such precision that it not only held the listening device firmly in place without adhesive, but also blocked out ambient street noise, rendering the Russian transmissions more intelligible. Over time, OTS experimented with other methods for transmission surveillance. In one design, the smaller induction coil was placed in a smoking pipe, called the tooth fairy. The case officer could hold the pipe in his teeth and hear through bone-conducted vibrations transmitted along his jaw to his ear canal. Another engineering concept using bone conduction called for incorporating the Phonak circuitry into the bridge of an officer's set of false teeth. Within 2 years, the technology had progressed from correlating KGB radio communications with surveillance to being able to identify locations and activities of surveillance teams. A case officer could now walk out on the street, monitor the transmissions, and know with certainty whether or not he had surveillance. "When I heard that transmission and knew I'd been called out, I knew I was, for whatever reason, of some interest to them on that day," said a tech about his Moscow experience. "I didn't know whether or not they were calling me out to a surveillance team that was waiting around the corner, or because they needed instructions about whether I was a target that day. I just knew that if the transmissions continued, they were looking at me. If the transmissions ceased, I knew there was a good chance I was free. And if the transmissions resumed later, I knew the KGB had me back on their active list." The CIA's accumulated operational experience, combined with OTS technological countermeasures, revealed that the KGB surveillance apparatus, while daunting, was by no means perfect. A key to operational success became patience, as case officers learned that weeks, even months, of routine activity in pattern and profile was often necessary to set the stage for a single clandestine act. In time, case officers discovered that even under surveillance, they could sometimes go black, vanish from sight, for relatively brief periods without setting off alarm bells. Soviet-style clothing, for instance, might be enough to blend into the population for relatively brief periods of time, just long enough to perform an operational act, and pop up again in view of the watchers, who no doubt breathed a sigh of relief. Personnel in Moscow called this operating through the gap. Such risky acts depended on a well-established pattern of travel, so that when the officer briefly disappeared, the KGB surveillance teams would assume that it was their error to have lost him. By the early 1980s, those skeptical that the CIA could operate in Moscow had been silenced with several remarkable clandestine successes. Viktor Shamov, a brilliant engineer from the KGB's 8th Directorate, Communication Security and Signals Intelligence, had been smuggled out of the USSR with his wife and daughter in May 1980. A.G. Tolkachev was reporting regularly about advanced Soviet aviation developments during clandestine meetings in Moscow. Although Trigon had been lost in 1977, he, along with another agent, codenamed A.E. Beep, a GRU general, had been handled successfully inside, and new technical collection systems were being deployed. Technology was melting some of the iron in the Iron Curtain. Chapter 10. A Dissident at Heart. I have chosen a course which does not permit one to move backward, and I have no intention of veering from this course. A.G. Tolkachev, as quoted in Studies in Intelligence. Clandestine operations inside the Soviet Union through the 1970s steadily increased along with reliance on new spy devices. These operations, although relatively small in number, were growing in frequency and yielding successes that would have been unimaginable in the Penkovsky era. Agent operations, once wholly dependent on the traditional tools of secret writing, signal sights, and dead drops, were undergoing a technological revolution and defeating the KGB counterintelligence apparatus. The new generation of equipment focused on three areas critical for running agent operations: copying documents, communicating with agents, and countering surveillance. Prior to 1970, techniques for agent communications were limited to a small number of proven techniques, primarily secret writing, microdots, radio broadcasts, and dead drops. Now, materials, electronics, chemistry, and miniaturization were transforming agent operations. Technical capability was becoming integral to operational planning and execution. Whether it was an electronic surveillance package, such as the SRR-100 or the T-100 subminiature camera, denied area operations received the first run of every new device that flowed out of OTS, or at least got first crack at it. A new piece of spy gear provided the element of surprise, since the longer an item was in use, the more likely it would be exposed by defecting agents and subsequently susceptible to technical countermeasures. Moscow, where operations were largely dependent on the new gadgetry, was to become the proving ground in modern espionage. High-tech spy gear was new territory for agent operations, and critical questions had to be answered. For example, would an agent accept impersonal handling? How will the equipment be delivered? How are agents trained? Can the agents be trusted with gear that cost millions of dollars to develop? Can the agent reliably operate the new technology? If a device malfunctions, how will it be repaired? Where can the agent hide obvious spy gear? A second, more subtle change had also taken place among case officers. Almost all agency personnel working in Moscow were baby boomers, just a few years out of college. 30 years later, photographs of the era surprise even those who posed for them. The now fading pictures show grinning youths, relaxed and dressed in the casual American fashions of the day. This change in appearance by the 60s generation confounded the KGB, making it more difficult for them to pinpoint the intelligence officers who now dressed in the casual fashions of the 1970s rather than official-looking suits and ties. In part, youth was also an operational requirement, since the KGB monitored all Americans in Moscow. Once an American was identified as being CIA, he was flagged throughout all subsequent postings and into retirement. A hint of suspicion would earn the officer additional surveillance. Officers began building their official covers months, sometimes years, before leaving for an assignment. They learned the procedures, lingo, and customs of their cover jobs, so by the time they arrived in the Soviet Union, they were virtually indistinguishable from their non-intelligence colleagues. Years after returning home to a Washington suburb, one TOO remembered, with some pride, being approached by a former colleague who inquired whether his wife, and not he, had been a spy. Youthful officers provided another, though unexpected, operational benefit. The baby boomers were, compared to the earlier generation of officers, comfortable with the pace of technological innovation. They had grown up with consumer products being regularly introduced, updated, and drifting into obsolescence. In their experience, one technology always supplanted another. Every gadget got smaller, more reliable, and less expensive. If a transistor was better than a vacuum tube, then a printed circuit board was superior to a transistor, and another advance could be expected within a few years. This expectation carried over from consumer products to a constant demand for newer, smaller, and more reliable spy gear. Just as the class of scientists that entered OTS in the 1960s found technology in the lab lagging behind what existed in private research centers, the new case officers entering the DO in the 1970s discovered that their expectations of spy gadgets outpaced the reality. The fantasy of 1960s TV spy shows, such as Get Smart and Mission Impossible, together with the popularity of the James Bond movies, had changed expectations about the role technology played in supporting operations. Ops officers began to believe that the magic of engineering and spy gadgetry they saw in Q's laboratory might be, at least on some level, real. Senior OTS officers recalled temporarily reassigning techs to telephone duty to handle inquiries on the day following the airing of new episodes of Mission Impossible. Most of the calls were from operations officers who wanted to know, could OTS do that? Case officers did not need to understand the physics that put Neil Armstrong and his crew on the moon. It was enough to know it was possible. The same was true about the science behind a dry secret-writing carbon paper or a battery that would last 20 years in an eavesdropping device. All that mattered was that it worked, was reliable, and met the operational requirement at hand. As technology advanced, CIA scientists began designing large-scale, highly sophisticated technical collection platforms. In many cases, these plans were so imaginative they led to a conflict between the technically possible and operationally realistic. A technically viable operation, from the perspective of a Langley laboratory, could represent an unacceptably high risk for the case officer facing KGB surveillance in Moscow. Another problem arose when sophisticated equipment that performed flawlessly in the lab proved impractical to maintain and service in the field. To resolve these conflicts between technology and operations in Moscow, the TOO became the trusted intermediary between the cadre of scientists at Langley and the case officers in Moscow. The TOO's role was that of translating case officers' requirements into the technical language of engineers and making technical constraints understandable to the ops planners. Case officers needed to appreciate the limitations as well as the capabilities these advanced systems offered, while the design engineers had to recognize the clandestine realities of the denied area. Back in the late 70s and early 80s, the DO and OTS regularly received proposals for technical collection operations in denied areas, recalled one tech who served in Moscow. A scenario could require getting someone 50 kilometers outside the city, carrying 80 pounds of equipment, then climbing a tree to a height of about 100 feet, putting a collection package up there, and aligning the antenna to within a degree or two, while evading surveillance the entire time. Well, as valid as the target or the operation might be, the likelihood of ever being able to do it was slim to none. The culture of the DO added yet another hurdle for technical operations. Large-scale technical collection systems transformed the traditional roles between case officer and technology. Essential technology, such as secret writing, document photography, and agent communications, historically had served the DO as an aid to agent operations. However, technical collection operations in a hostile country were new. When technology became the means for collecting intelligence, the role of the DO sometimes shifted to supporting the collection rather than managing it. Some DO case officers felt that they were being asked to carry all of the operational risks in denied areas, while any successes were credited to the technology. And the risks were high. Like agent operations, a compromised technical program could expose methods of collection, result in the arrest of officers, create an international incident, and jeopardize other ongoing but unrelated intelligence activities. Dmitry Fyodorovich Polyakov, a career Soviet intelligence officer who eventually rose to the rank of lieutenant general within the GRU, began life as a spy for the United States at almost the same time as Penkovsky in 1961 and continued his clandestine work through the 1970s. During his service as an agent for U.S. intelligence, Polyakov was a pioneer in the transition from the CIA's reliance on traditional low-tech to innovative high-tech tradecraft. Polyakov was recruited in New York in 1961 by the FBI as a counterintelligence source. He provided identities of illegals working for Soviet intelligence within the United States, as well as the names of several Americans who were Soviet penetrations of the U.S. government. After his reassignment in 1966, Polyakov was handed off to the CIA and continued reporting from a series of postings in Burma, India, and the Philippines. Rising within the ranks of the GRU, he accumulated a long list of CIA code names, including GT Beep, Top Hat, and Bourbon. Top Hat requested little money from his case officers and accepted only a few small gifts from the agency, such as woodworking tools and a couple of shotguns for hunting. Motivated primarily by his hatred of the Soviet system, he saw himself as a proud Russian, but a reluctant Soviet. One case officer who knew Polyakov well described the agent as capable of both intense moments of pride in the Soviet military while simultaneously despising the system it served. He was the consummate professional. During a turnover meeting in India in the late 1970s, when a departing CIA case officer introduced his replacement, Polyakov noted the new officer's neatly trimmed beard. "We don't allow beards in the GRU," commented Polyakov. At the next meeting, when the two case officers arrived at a hotel room safe house in advance of Polyakov, the senior officer asked the replacement why he had not shaved the beard. "Why should I?" asked the younger man. "What our friend was telling you," explained the senior officer, "is that a GRU general is not comfortable being with someone wearing a beard. It could raise questions." The young officer got a razor from the front desk, went into the bathroom, and shaved off his beard. Shortly thereafter, Polyakov arrived and immediately complimented his new case officer on neatness and appearance. The turnover went smoothly, although the officer's wife found it curious that, after wearing a beard for several years, her husband, without warning or explanation, had suddenly decided to go clean-shaven. Understandably, the agency and FBI were eager to keep this pipeline of counterintelligence, which had grown over the years to encompass Soviet espionage operations outside the United States as well. Polyakov also reported on the Red Army and its armaments, including biological and chemical weapons programs. if one were to judge the value of intelligence by the number of customers who used the information, then Polyakov's product was priceless. His information flowed from the CIA to the Pentagon, White House, and State Department. In the assessment of officers who worked with him, Polyakov was a nearly perfect spy. Not only was he highly placed within the military structure, he possessed the training and discipline of a skilled intelligence officer. Because he understood KGB counterintelligence tactics, Polyakov proved to be an extremely cautious agent. Methods of covert communications were changed frequently to lower the risks as much as possible. Initially, he communicated using OTS's latest secret writing techniques and conventional dead drops. Outside the USSR, he employed brush passes and received signals via personal ads placed in the New York Times under the name Donald F. These methods required significant time and planning, and carried with them varying amounts of risk. None permitted real-time or near-real-time exchanges with the case officer in case of an emergency. We had an agent providing us with critical counterintelligence and positive intelligence about military policies, technical information on Soviet equipment, and penetrations of the American government. These are invaluable reports, but whatever he had, it had to be condensed into short messages of a few hundred words, laboriously written down and ciphered using an OTP, said one of his ops officers. Because Polyakov didn't have a private place to work, this was all done while hiding in a closet or sitting on the john. His family didn't know about his secret work, and his children, wife, and mother-in-law were living in his apartment. He had to sit and work with these miniature one-time pads and encipher all this information prior to sending it to us and decipher what we sent him. Then Polyakov had to go outside, take a deep breath, put down a dead drop in a public place and hope he was not seen, and that the case officer found it before anybody stumbled across it. The operation needed a device enabling the agency to communicate quickly and securely with an agent while lowering the risk of compromise. The dilemma of securely communicating with Polyakov was solved while he was posted to India, 1973-76, when the CIA developed its first electronic short-range agent communication system for use in a denied area. The new SHRAC device, a form of burst transmitter, carried the code name Buster. Measuring approximately 6 by 3 by 1 inches and weighing just over half a pound, the unit was small enough to conceal easily in a coat pocket. Buster had a tiny single-digit display with a Cyrillic type font and a keyboard that was no longer than an inch and a half square. To load a message, Polyakov would first convert his text into a cipher using a one-time pad, then poke at the tiny keyboard one character at a time to store up to 1,500 characters. After the data was loaded, Polyakov would contrive a reason to go within the transmitter's 1,000-foot range of the base station receiver and press the send button. The receiver base station was a larger unit, measuring approximately 8.5 by 11 by 5 inches thick, and typically sat in one of several windowsills of agency residences or in parked cars. Because base stations were maintained in multiple locations, Polyakov could vary his transmission points, making his pattern of movement around the city difficult, if not impossible, for any KGB watchers to discern. Buster's burst signal minimized transmission time, thereby limiting the KGB's ability to detect the signal and pinpoint its source. When Polyakov returned to Moscow, he could communicate while riding in a car, streetcar, or bus, or when walking or riding a bicycle, simply by pressing a button on the device in his pocket during the few seconds he was within range. He could now send electronic messages at the time and location of his choosing. Better still, the communication link was two-way. Once the base station received the message, it replied with a confirmation signal and transmitted its own preloaded, though more limited, character set back to the agent's unit. All this occurred in less than 5 seconds. He would poke in his message, then go out for his walk or on an errand. he had been informed of the general area, but not specific location, of the base station. Once he got into range,